I'm very happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Thomas Alina. He is a community psychologist. He teaches in the Peace Studies program at the University of New Mexico. He is the author of a book called Restorative Justice on the College Campus. And this Friday and Saturday, he is doing some events with the Jung Institute here in Santa Fe, which we'll talk about toward the end of the program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you back. Now, how did you start doing this work with history and the history of conflict and trauma in New Mexico?
Well, I think if you were to look back, if I were to look back and see where the genesis of this was it was my work in restorative justice here in New Mexico. And I began to see generations of events that come through the criminal justice system that you begin to see it in a more integrated kind of fashion. So we have grandfathers, fathers, daughters, grandchildren who come through a system. And I got curious about that whole phenomenon. The other thing I would say is living in Taos, there was a substantial amount of conflict and violence that seemed to transcend what I understood it to be. And I needed to understand a little better some of the issues with it. So fast forward to my doctoral work in depth psychology and also in something called liberation psychology. And I got very curious about the ways in which trauma transmits across generations and how historical events tend to leave legacies. They have aftermath and what we call legacies. And so I began to look for a nexus between what we knew about history and contemporary types of trauma, you know, that would manifest in patterns of violence, looking at DWI fatalities in our state, looking at overdose, looking at addiction. And I began to understand that what we were doing, in some respects, were treating the symptoms of some of these historical events.
So let's talk about some of these events specifically regarding New Mexico. What events are we looking at, and how do they result in DWIs and drug addiction?
Well, I think the best to understand this, I think you've got to go all the way back in history. And my contention is that here in New Mexico, we have a 400-year history of colonization, trauma transmission that comes from that, and we begin to see patterns that evolve over time. So we could go back as early as the late 15th century and work forward. And what we see are practically unbroken patterns of conflict, and they're contemporary as well. I don't think that, you know, contemporary events such as the, why is it that New Mexico has the worst prison riot in the history of American penology? What's the impact of the development of the Los Alamos labs and the fact that it's the birthplace of nuclear destruction? So when you look longitudinally at patterns over time, what we see here is somewhat of an unbroken history.
And so you have the Spanish conquest of the Indians, you have the white American, Anglo-American conquest of, or taking over of New Mexico, you call it conquest.
American imperialism. When you look at concepts like manifest destiny, what you see are deliberately targeted campaigns to eliminate particular cultures and races. So to think that that doesn't have long-term impacts, I would argue that in fact it does, and we see it today in our state. My doctoral dissertation research really began to look at one such event involving the Navajo and the Navajo Long Walk and their internment at the Bosque Redondo. And I looked at contemporary narratives of these events and what patterns we began to see, and I'll discuss this this coming Friday and into Saturday, were narratives that were basically written that carry legacies. Legacies of oppression, legacies of colonization. And I don't believe events like this have ever truly been reconciled where all voices have been heard.
Tell us about that particular event, the Long Walk.
Well, it, you know, recently it's come up, if you've followed some of the media accounts in Taos, where the Taos Town Council wanted to rename Kit Carson Park, it was decided, and it created a bit of a community uproar when they opted, probably without enough forethought, to change the name to Red Willow Park. And before you knew it, we were in the middle of history again. We were talking about the character of and some of the acts of Mr. Carson, Colonel Carson. So we begin to see legacies that are with us today, that the opportunity to explore issues like this created a lot of community unrest.
Now, you're sort of skirting around the issue of violence, but not actually talking about anything that actually really happened. What are some of the long walk? What happened?
Well, what happened was it involved the General James Carleton, who directed this campaign, part of the scorched earth policy, directed Colonel Carson to round up both the Navajo people and the Mescalero Apache. First the Mescalero and then the Apache. And they were forcibly marched from the Four Corners area to what's now known as the Bosque Redondo, which is just outside of in DeBaca County. So what we began to see in that event was calamity. You know, where the march between the march and the internment over the course of 4 years led to the deaths of some, they estimate anywhere from a fifth to a third of the Navajo people. And those events today would be characterized as genocide. Anytime you would eliminate, either directly or indirectly, anywhere from a fifth to a third of any population would be considered genocidal. So the loss of lives, you know, whether they were part of good intentions on the part of the United States government or not, have deeply impacted that particular culture.
Now, how does trauma get transmitted from parents to children to grandchildren and so on?
Well, there are several theories about that. One theory I would turn to comes out of the University of Virginia. There's a researcher there by the name of Vomit Volkan. I'll be talking about his work Friday night. And he talks about the transgenerational aspects of trauma. And basically his research came out of looking at the survivors of the death camps in World War II. And what he found in survivors and their descendants were mental images were passed from survivor to descendant with the symptomology as if the descendants had been in the camps themselves in some respects. So what we began to see was a nexus between the survivor and the descendants, and it's fairly common that people who suffer mass trauma like this do not talk openly about it. I mean, we certainly saw that characteristic in Volkan's research, but it's common to most mass genocides.
I mean, I think that's the thing that's kind of fascinating about it, which it would be great if you could help us understand, is you've got a generation of people who were so traumatized that they didn't talk about it, and yet their children experienced it as if they had been there without their parents having talked about it.
That's right.
How does that...
Well, from a psychoanalytic perspective, mental images get passed. In the absence of any overt words or any overt discussions, Volkan found that mental images have been passed.
Mental images?
That's right.
What's a mental image?
Well, a mental image is a psychological concept that you hold. It could come through a dream image. It could come through some unconscious passing of an event that constellates in the form of an internal image. So it's an internalized experience that's unique to the person who experiences it. So it could come in many, many different forms.
Does it get less from generation to generation? Is it diluted?
Well, actually quite the opposite. What researchers such as Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart, who coined the term historical trauma, gave us, that these events or these passing actually become cumulative unless they're addressed. So think about some of the historical events that happened several hundred years ago that get passed across generations. Now, can you empirically study this? Not so well. But I do think that when you look at events today and the symptomology, one of the missing pieces is that these events represent the legacies of these historical events that, again, rarely get talked about, and even less so in terms of reconciliation socially.
Well, let's talk about reconciliation and, I mean, healing. If you have a trauma and the idea is to heal not only the person but the society, how does that work in a place where basically the conquest has been successful, you know, the the white guys won, or however you want to put it?
Some of it has to do with really our understanding a fuller account of history. Most of history, let's take the Bosque Redondo, for example. Many authors have written about it, but largely it's been written from the perspective, as most history is, of that of the victors. So we only have half the story. In the case of the Fort Sumner experience of the Navajo, it's largely written from military records. We don't know, you know, we only have, because of oral histories, because of also Navajo perspectives that say you do not go back to places where our ancestors perished. You don't talk about it, you don't go back. But yet there are consequences for that, I would assert. One graphic account that I found was really quite interesting was a couple of years back in the Santa Fe Film Festival. There was a piece that I believe won the Audience Jury Award, developed by two Israeli women called Sunkissed. And in that documentary, they follow the Navajo couple across the res, particularly here, especially here in New Mexico, to find answers to why, in fact, they had two children born with this very rare genetic disease called XP. XP is a genetic bottleneck issue that comes in the form of children born, they cannot be exposed to any sunlight whatsoever. So they have to be completely bundled up when they go out of doors. And the other thing is that there's a parallel brain degeneration that goes with it. Children born with this rarely live past the age of 11 or 12. And this Navajo couple had actually two children, even though in the mainstream population this disease is one in a million, whereas on the reservation out there it was one, I believe, in 20 or 30,000. So a significant statistical difference. And as they search for these answers and come up empty, they find other families who are burdened with the same issue with their children. So as they dig deeper and they talk to geneticists, they begin to learn from the genetic perspective that this particularly contemporary issue traces back to the Navajo Long Walk, when in fact so much of that particular population was reduced. The child-producing population was reduced to, they estimated 3,000 child-producing adults that now have 300,000 descendants. So recessive genes were passed. So from where I began to look at, this is a contemporary effect of something that happened 150 years ago that now we can medically and genetically begin to look at.
So that's an interesting case, because what you have is a recessive gene that never would have manifested otherwise because of a massacre, a genocide. There's other things like drug addiction, which are not so much, they're not genetic manifestations, but they are, I think you could probably argue, manifestations of trauma. How do you understand the prevalence of drug addiction in northern New Mexico?
I think it's a complex issue. I don't think it's a singular issue that relates, for instance, only to poverty. I think poverty is certainly part of it, but I do think that some of the roots of issues like substance abuse addiction, with the rates are as substantial as they are, have to do with our long history of colonization, appropriation of land, appropriation of culture. Now, can we make a direct linkage to them? Probably empirically, no. But I often have wondered why rates in New Mexico are so much substantially higher than other places. Why are our DWI fatalities so significant? Why are drug overdose deaths so high, particularly in Riaruba County? What's the nexus here? Are they just all related to, are they unrelated? And I would think that there's a relationship to what I understand in the literature having to do with the fact that colonization leaves legacies, and these are the manifestation of those legacies. In some respects, it's not to suggest that we should ignore dealing with them as they exist today in behavioral health. We need to. But nevertheless, one of the things that we do not talk about here is the impact of history and how it affects us today.
Now, you were giving a lecture this Friday, the 5th of September, called Place, Voice, and Containment, Pathways to Transforming Conflict and Violence. And then the next day, Saturday, you're giving a workshop called Finding Our Way Back, Reconciling People and Places in New Mexico. Presumably some of the themes that we've been talking about just now. What happens in the workshop? Who should come to it? Who's it for?
Well, I think there will be largely people from the social sciences. I think there will be behavioral health people and certainly therapists who see the manifestation of this phenomena in their clients on an everyday type of basis. My hope is that there are people who are current practitioners in the field of addiction will join us to bring their ideas about this, because it'll be an exploration is what it'll be. One of the task forces I was able to sit on, I'm very proud of the work done of the law enforcement assisted diversion here in New Mexico, or in Santa Fe actually, where the city has taken this on as a way, as an alternative approach to dealing with heroin addiction here in the city. And I do think that there are a lot of people looking at this from several different vantage points. It's one of the few interdisciplinary types of gatherings, practitioners who are interested in looking at this from multiple perspectives. So I think the more interdisciplinary these sessions can become, and hearing from various vantage points, I also want to present a framework that's being used around the world right now called Transforming Historical Harms. It's being used all over this country. It's being used in historical conflicts from Cambodia, from Yugoslavia, certainly in a number of African contexts. But here in the States, it's being used, for instance, the state of Maine right now has started a process to look at the impact of the boarding school process on Native communities throughout the state. So there is a commission, so to speak, that's going from community to community collecting narratives. So we'll be looking at some other contemporary uses of frameworks like this. Another one is the city of Tulsa. Tulsa is beginning to look at the historical implications of the Tulsa race riots from early in the 20th century.
I have a question. I mean, you can talk about the effect of trauma on the Native people who are in boarding schools, and I think it's a very important thing to talk about everywhere, including here in New Mexico. What is the effect on the victors, on the conquerors?
Well, I think there's an equal effect. I don't think that trauma is limited only to those who suffer the losses. My sense of it is that the victors also carry the shame associated with trauma. Now, most of it's carried unconsciously. As a community psychologist, I'm not always looking at behavior, but I'm also looking at what's carried in the unconscious, what comes through the dream time, what comes through affective states such as what we just saw in Taos. Why would the renaming of a park create such an uproar among people? So I'm not always sure that it's carried consciously. I think there are unconscious dimensions in how it's carried. And I would add that this goes back to a point that Volkan made. Volkan made a point of what he noticed in his research that said, essentially, what we do not address and reconcile will be passed in the form of unconscious tasks, he called them, to our descendants, to the next generation. So the fact that this trauma, the fact that we do not talk about it, we don't have open dialogue about it, almost ensures that our children will deal with it. And if they don't deal with it, then our grandchildren will deal with it. In other words, it doesn't dissipate with the passage of time because we don't talk about it.
I think one of the things that it's hard for people to talk about who are not land-based people is the trauma that people whose identity was the land go through when that land is stripped away, whether it be Native American people or Hispanic land-grant people or whatever. Those of us who blithely move from New England or California or whatever and buy a house, we're not land-based people. We could buy one house or rent an apartment or whatever, and it doesn't matter. You move, so what? But if you are a land-based person and that's taken away, the trauma, it's like it's in your body.
Yes. That's a very good point. No, I totally agree with it. And I would say it extends beyond the body. That one of the things I'll be talking about on Saturday is a concept called eco-psychology and a form of that called Terra, T-E-R-R-A, psychology, earth-based psychology, which informs us that we, whether we believe it or not, whether it's part of our Western cosmology, but like so many native peoples, we are intricately connected to the landscapes, and that the landscapes themselves are conduits for both trauma and healing both. But it requires us to take a less literal, a less scientific perspective. It requires us to kind of enter with a little bit more curiosity, a little bit more imagination, and a ways in which we can listen to the earth in a way that I think begins to break up that disconnection that we have. We begin to rediscover those connecting points, and we can begin to see phenomena that happens in the landscape. And in fact, the landscape speaks to us.
Tom Alina is a community psychologist. He teaches in the Peace Studies program at the University of New Mexico. And once again, this Friday and Saturday, he's doing a lecture and a workshop at the C.G. Jung Institute here in Santa Fe. Where does that take place, and how can people find out more information?
I believe it's going to take place at the Center for Spiritual Living on Marquez, 505 Camino de los Marquez in Santa Fe. And if you want information for registering for the workshop, call Dr. Jacqueline West at area code 505-984-0102. And she's with the C.G. Jung Institute.
Excellent. Tom, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be back with you.